From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Novelist Ha Jin made a big name for himself writing about his home country, China, and the hard, gray side of Mao's communist state. Now he's turned his pen to his adopted country, America. In his new novel, A Free Life, he writes about a post-Tiananmen Chinese emigre's struggle to find his way and heart in the American dream. It's fiction, but it echoes Ha Jin's own life story. This hour, On Point novelist Ha Jin and a Chinese journey into America. Joining me now in the studio is celebrated novelist and poet Ha Jin. Only 9 years after coming to the U.S., he won the National Book Award and Penn Faulkner Award for his novel, Waiting. He's won the Flannery O'Connor Prize for short fiction. The New Yorker says reading Ha Jin is like falling in love. His new novel is A Free Life. Welcome, Ha Jin. Great to have you here again.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So, you've sat in America and written a lot about your early years and impressions of China. This time, you turn your immigrant eye on this country. Why? Are you finished with China?
In fact, I did say publicly that I was finished with contemporary China. You know, I may write about China in other period, but contemporary China is basically finished to me. And as for the immigrant life, I am an immigrant. Mm-hmm. You know, I've lived in this country for more than 22 years, mm-hmm. and the experience is very close to my heart. And really, and that's why I plan to write about this experience for a long time.
You've got a Chinese immigrant who's at the heart of your new novel, A Free Life, who wants to make it in America but struggles with what that means. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, this is a man who does not want to run a Chinese restaurant. He wants to be a poet. So you put him in very special circumstances, kind of Ha Jin circumstances in many ways. He makes a life as described here between Boston and New York and Atlanta. But I wish you'd introduce us a little bit to the family at the heart of your story, the Wu family.
Yes.
Chinese immigrants, the father, Nan.
Yes.
The wife, Ping Ping.
Yes.
And their young son, who had been in China while they got started. Early in the book, he comes to the States.
Yes.
Tao. Introduce us to the family.
So the family, the father came first as a graduate student in political science at Brandeis University. And 2.5 years later, and a year and a half later, his wife came, Ping Ping came to join him here.
This would have been in the late 80s.
Yes, 1987. Mm-hmm. And 2.5 years later, immediately after the Tiananmen Square massacre, their son, Tao Tao, came to join them. So now this is the point. Finally, it took 4 years for them to be together, and now they decided to start a new life here.
The pro-democracy demonstrations in the main square in Beijing, Tiananmen, and their brutal crushing by the Chinese military plays a very important role in your life and immigration decisions, and in the decisions and view of the world of the Wu family in your new book.
Sure. And because Nan did plan to return to China to teach, and after that tragedy, he decided to immigrate. Especially after his son's arrival, he wanted his son to be an American, and that's why he decided to stay. Sure, there are some autobiographical elements here.
You also planned to go back to China when you first came to the States.
Yes.
You also had the experience of watching Tiananmen from this country, that tragedy in the capital of your old country. How did you feel when you watched it? How does that come through in your character's view here?
Yeah, I'm slightly different because I had served in the Chinese army. So for me, it was perhaps even more painful because when I was a kid in the army, basically.
The People's Army.
Yeah, the People's Army. I was instructed to serve the people, and the army was from the people, but now suddenly everything was reversed. And I was in a shock for weeks. I couldn't function normally, in fact, and I was totally confused and didn't know what to do about my own life. I was working on a dissertation that aimed for the Chinese job market, and suddenly I felt totally lost.
and marooned or newly wedded to America.
Yeah, but I you know, that's why I'm, you know, my life, I'm much more fortunate. It took me a year to decide to write English, but it took then over a decade, in fact, big struggle to reach that point.
Your career went on a kind of a golden path. You describe him working in Chinese restaurants before he starts his own.
Sure.
It's tough. It's hard scrabble.
Sure.
They're doing a lot of chopping scallions and frying up General Gao's chicken.
Yes. And, you know, I never worked in a Chinese restaurant.
Right.
I always work in American Italian restaurants. But I did, when I was in Georgia, I visited some small restaurants just to figure out how it worked there.
And like your main character. Your life migrated from Boston south to Georgia for a while.
Yes, that part, yes, overlap with my own story. But really, the story, the book was conceived long ago. In fact, it was in the winter of 1992. A friend of mine, Jennifer Rose, who was the managing editor at the Agony Review, she one day she gave me a book of poems in Chinese, written in Chinese, in the archaic form. And she said that was given to her by a small restaurant owner in Waltham, a recent immigrant from Hong Kong. I was very touched by that book. That's when, you know, the idea for the novel started. But of course, at the time, I didn't have the experience. I couldn't write a book like this. I would have to live through the process to understand the subtleties and nuances.
The aspiration, not just to be a Chinese restaurateur, but a poet, is a big part of Nan's struggle in this book. You describe him at what point he's written poems, he thinks maybe they're silly, he's got one that he's held on to, and kind of along the lines you've just described, it's tucked into the pages of an ancient poetry anthology compiled by Confucius, the Book of Songs. So his own little effort tucked into the great text of Confucius.
Yeah.
You know, Americans have been reading Chinese immigrant novelists for quite a while now, with Maxine Kong Kingston and Amy Tan.
Yeah.
You're really writing about a new generation of immigrant, much more contemporary.
Sure.
How do you see your immigrant story, the one you're telling in the new book, A Free Life, differing in its focus, in its themes, in its feeling from these earlier stories Americans have read? Amy Tan, Maxine Hong Kingston.
Sure. And, you know, I read those books and admired them, but they were younger generations. Basically, they told the stories of their parents or grandparents.
Families that had come to the United States quite long ago.
Yes. So very often the generation gap or conflict was the big theme. And in my case, this is basically a book about the first decade of these new arrivals, how they struggle and survive. I think it also, in a way, that reflects the current or contemporary situation of immigration. And a lot of immigrants are now, they arrive as adults, not children anymore. Mm-hmm. And many of them are very skilled and knowledgeable as professionals. So, in other words, people are different. The new immigrants are slightly different from the older generations.
How does your main character, Nan, the father in this family, the would-be poet, how does he understand the American dream when he first arrives, and how does his understanding of it evolve, change?
See, for him, I think that, yes, there was an evolution, a whole process for him to understand the nature, or at least his interpretation for American dream.
Mm-hmm. Everyone has their own.
Yes, I think that's the beauty of it. Everybody should have his or her own. And when he arrived, he planned to return to China, so that American dream was not his concern almost. But once he decided to stay, he followed the same path of most immigrants. And at that time, of course, he tried to survive, just make money and try to buy a home and buy a business. And so for him, at that point, he followed the popular version of American Dream.
As it's understood.
Yes.
The home, the car in the driveway.
And sure, yes. And I think it was a fact that at the time, it was not that difficult in Georgia. because housing in real estate was not that expensive.
And he ends up feeling kind of sour about that,
sure.
saying, that wasn't hard, that wasn't difficult enough, that was too, that's the dream, that was too easy.
Yes.
And he ends up quoting Emerson, you know, hitch your
wagon to the star.
To a star, saying, what, maybe I must aim higher.
Sure, sure.
And he does.
Yeah, and in a way, because he's a kind of typical case in very short period of time. Basically, he traveled the path of a whole generation of immigrants. And because of his situation, it was possible. But he wasn't just 40. What to do with the rest of his life? He was confused and lost.
Mm. There are so many great insights and moments in the book, and we're going to come back and dive into all of them. Do you think Chinese immigrants are going to continue coming to the United States? Or with China booming, is the attraction of the United States diminished?
I think there will be a lot, but won't be as many. That's my hunch. I could be wrong, but I think a lot of people, as long as they can live comfortable back in China, they would not move. That's human nature.
lots of questions here, Ha Jin. One, you've got an interesting relationship with his wife.
Yes.
She's lovely and all that, but he's got a love still back in China who
yes.
he pines for, even as they're
sure.
together here. But when she first comes, she has this struggle. A struggle to speak her mind.
Yes.
Openly and directly
sure.
in the American fashion as opposed
yes.
to what she was accustomed to in China. She said, you write that it was better to be yourself. Here nobody could really help you and only you could save yourself. In addition, she didn't want to be a fake as she had tried to be back in China where people had to lie to get things done and to keep themselves from danger. When she'd come to the States 6.5 years before, she hadn't been able to speak comfortably for months because she didn't know how to talk without lying.
Yeah.
Explain that to an American audience. What is that about?
You know, in China, this is my personal experience and many others, I think, as well. And it's sometimes you have to lie in order to protect yourself because you have to follow the lines, the party's lines. And
even now, today?
Sure.
We thought it was, you know, whatever cat catches the mouse.
Sure, I think, yeah, even a lot of officials, they have to lie constantly. They don't believe what they say, but everybody has to lie to some degree in order to survive. I think, especially you know, when I was in China, it was very clear, and as a result, a lot of people here and new arrivals
mm-hmm.
and they felt uncomfortable in the beginning, didn't know how to speak honestly the American way. It really takes time. It takes time, usually a few months, for them to get used to the American fashion, to really just say what you mean.
Was that way immediately appealing to you when you observed it, or was it off-putting? Was it even, did it seem rude or I don't know, frightening?
Sometimes frightening, yeah, off-putting as well. But I think gradually people, you know, they will get used to it. I think they prefer them. Most people would prefer the American way, just to speak your mind.
Mm. But there's also a kind of aloneness you describe.
Sure.
There's a letter that comes to Nan from his father.
Yes.
And he says, my son, I hate to reiterate this, but I have to say it again. He says, don't put on airs and insulate yourself.
Sure.
Try to befriend as many people as possible,
sure.
that is, in America.
Yeah.
You don't know who may hold out a helpful hand in your hour of need.
Yeah.
And his son, I mean, this is pretty frank language, but his son's thinking in response, the old bugger, you write, the old bugger's full of crap, he says to himself.
So, yeah.
What's the cultural difference in view that Nan has learned there?
In China, I think it's still the case. Most people live in networks. Basically, you have to have a lot of friends, connections in order to get things done. In order to live a decent life, you have to have a lot of friends. But in the United States, it's not that the case. You have to be independent. Sure, you have friends, but you can't depend on relationships. You have to be self-sufficient. But his father did not understand the situation here.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he advised him to follow the old way to make friends. And that's why Nan responded very negatively.
And that being on your own, he says, it infects even the Chinese community here. He says, sure. Besides, here, all the Chinese here have changed and become self-centered, won't share time and resources with others. Everyone is struggling to keep himself from sinking. It's not like China.
That's true. New arrivals, I think, you know, psychologically, most new immigrants are frightened at a new place, very often in a new language. So the reference frame has partially collapsed, and people were confused and frightened. As a result, they are driven by the instinct for survival. And so I think that's why Nan felt that suddenly a lot of the Chinese had become self-centered.
Mm. Nan is trying to write poetry throughout here, and ultimately does just that.
Yes.
It's a winding road. He pays his dues along the way. But at one point, he's talking with his wife. I think they're in their restaurant in Atlanta, and there are Chinese visitors to this restaurant. And they have an awkward exchange with them. And afterward, Ping Ping says to Nan, she says, "You shouldn't have said that." He says, "Said what? That we have nothing to do with China." And they're speaking in Chinese here. They start to go back and forth between Chinese and English, but you've got it in italics to indicate that. "I know," he said, "I was just angry. If only we could squeeze the old country out of our blood." At what point does that happen for an immigrant? At what point did it happen to you? And does it happen for all Chinese?
I think for most immigrants, you know, there was always the love and hate relationship sometimes. That's why he said, "I wish," because he couldn't. That's the past of yourself, your heritage. You cannot erase it. It's impossible.
You write at one point he thought he could.
He thought he could.
Disassociate themselves, and then you say, "But now it was clear that China would never leave them alone. Wherever they went, the old land seemed to follow them."
Yes, that becomes also the old land in a way is within them somehow. That's why they could not do it. But for them, that was bad. You know, really, the old place somehow always reminded them of the suffering. But that's their life. They cannot really cut loose from it.
Is your view of China now outdated? Is it antique? Do young Chinese really feel that China stands for suffering?
But if you go to the countryside, and I think the majority, even vast majority of the people, common people, the suffering is still part of their life.
Away from the glamorous lights of Shanghai or Beijing.
Sure. The cities, of course, they are very different. Very different. They are, you know, even they live kind of modern life. People even can argue that some of them, not all, the rich ones, they can live a life similar to the life in the West. Mm. But the vast majority, they do not live the same life. And for instance, there used to be medical care, basic, very crude, basic medical care for the peasants, but now that was not available.
Mm-hmm.
And the way where I grew up, I never had access to a public library.
Mm-hmm.
One thing impressed me most in the United States is that every town has a decent library. But in China, that is not available, still not available.
And yet here's your protagonist, Nan. Mm-hmm. He's torn. You portray him at one point. He wants to be a poet, but he's not. He's a much more ordinary Chinese immigrant in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in the restaurant. He's working at the cutting board and at the sizzling wok, you say.
Mm-hmm.
And he keeps running through his mind lines from the poet Alexander Pope.
Yes.
"Happy the man whose wish and care a few paternal acres bound, content to breathe his native air in his own ground."
Yes.
Trying to figure out what that means for an immigrant.
You know, for the first time for him, you know, he's an employer of himself. He was not afraid of being fired. And
this restaurant is his own.
Yeah,
patch,
his own. Yeah, it's very small, but it's his own. So that's his own ground. For that moment, he was very content. I think that also that kind of elation also really has hit a lot of immigrants.
Once they finally find some firm ground to stand on in this country.
Self-reliance. But of course, later he got upset and disillusioned. But at that moment, the joy was absolutely genuine.
And the disillusionment with China in the first place. I wish you'd read one of the poems. There's a bit way back in the book, 633 here, but at the back of the book, people have talked about how there's a kind of Dr. Zhivago quality to this book. Very different story, but yet a kind of difficult wrestling with the homeland and a poet in times of
yes.
tumult and change. And there's a poem here called Revelation, where he's writing about these are poems, obviously, you've written, but as if they were nons, your
yes,
characters.
Yes.
And here he is, I guess, struggling with his understanding, his changed understanding of China.
Sure, sure.
Could you read for us?
Sure. Revelation. Suddenly he saw his mother's ugly face after seeing her smile for 30 years. Suddenly he heard her mother's monstrous voice, having remembered all her lullabies. Suddenly he found his mother's secret cookhouse, stocked with human flesh and blood. For the first time, he tasted the tears of rage and hated the nickname she called him. He soon left for a distant place where he has lived secluded.
Ha Jin, reading a poem, well, he wrote it, but for his character Nan in his new book, A Free Life. Let's begin to listen to our listeners. Andy's calling from Boston. Hi, Andy. You're on the air with Ha Jin.
Hello, Tom. Hello, hello, Arthur. Great show. And I'm finally be able to get on. One of the questions was, I've been here almost 7 years. I'm from southern India.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there comes a point where you're not sure if you, you know, how do you let go your, you know, past and the new land, kind of, you know. You know, you have family back home, and you know, it's one of those things where you're not sure whether to, you know, kind of blend into or just try to, you know, return back after you, you know, you've seen the new world.
That's the struggle. So your question there, Andy.
I guess my question is how, you know, how does the author try to approach that? You know, it's a difficult topic for most of us, and that question eventually has to get answered. But I guess how to answer it is the difficult point also.
Sure. And let me ask you, before Ha Jin comes in, you know, are you still, it sounds like you're still teetering on that decision. And are you afraid that you lose yourself or something important in yourself in deciding one way or the other?
Yes, and you know, what happens is, you know, you've gotten used to a certain kind of, you know, openness and freedom, and you know, when you go back to a different place, you, even though you are from that place, you still are trying to reconcile there too. So, you know, it's tough to be on which side of the river do you want to be? Do you want to be in the middle of the river? I think it's a nice way to put it, but
yeah,
I think that's not an option.
Sure, yeah. You know, I don't have a really clear answer to this, but I can only make some observations. Because I'm still in the process of struggling with this issue. But the past, very often, it can be a burden, and it can. Yeah, other words, the past can be freedom and also servitude. I think that the best way maybe is to view life as a journey. So the past should be used to facilitate our trips to somewhere. In other words, we cannot carry all the past on our shoulders. Then we can't move. It would be too much, too heavy.
When you say the past, do you mean the old country?
The old country of one's heritage and one's history and the family, everything. So that's why we have to figure out what part of our past is really useful, it's full of energy and resources, and we should use those parts. And at the same time, we try to move ahead with life, to really make a trip. I think the truth is, once you left the place, you have left for good. You cannot return to the same place as the same person. The place itself has changed too.
And maybe in no case more than China's, though if anything
sure.
challenges it,
yes.
it might be Andy's home country, India. India. Andy, thank you very much for your
thank
call.
Thank you, Andy.
We're talking with Ha Jin. His new book is A Free Life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me take a call from Eileen in Andover, Massachusetts. Eileen, you're on the air with Ha Jin.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ha Jin.
Hi,
what a pleasure. Ha Jin, what is your feeling being an immigrant, I am a first generation born here in the United States. My parents are from the Caribbean, born and raised here in the United States, but certainly holding on to basically my parents' heritage because it was instilled in me. What is your view, or how are you seeing the immigration problem that we are experiencing with the American government, with deportations and what have not? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Eileen. Hajin, how do you look at it? There's been such a hullabaloo about immigration. Here you're Chinese-American.
Sure.
You've seen in from Latin America many shipped back across borders. What do you make of it?
I think, you know, this country is built by immigrants. We should remember, you know, our parents, our great parents, forebears of the older generation, they were all immigrants, and so we should keep the continuity. We shouldn't take that kind of drastic and destructive measures just to ship people back, and we should really be more open-minded to this. And in fact, all the immigrants really contribute a great deal to American economy.
What do you say then to Americans, and there are many today, who say, we are losing our country? If we have open borders and millions come across and undocumented, a different culture, often speaking there of a Mexican culture, we're losing our nation. How does that sound to your immigrant ears?
I think that is kind of an exaggeration. We no country would open the borders completely, but there will be liberal measures to allow more people to come and work and to stay if they decided to become citizens here. And also nowadays, in fact, not just the regular, you know, farming workers or migrant workers. There are a lot of people with trained professionals. The United States does need them. In fact, we have to compete with other countries to get hold of them.
Do you sense sympathy in the Chinese-American community for, let's say, Mexican-American immigrants in particular? Or do you sense a desire to draw a distinction? We're Chinese, they're Mexican.
It really depends on where you live. Here, it's not really the Chinese. It seems to me here, Chinese immigrants and Mexican immigrants do not mix that much. But in Georgia, they work together. I knew some restaurant owners. They had Mexican staff who speak Chinese because they had worked with him for many years, and so really they work together. They mix quite well.
Mm-hmm. And therefore have sympathy one for the other.
Sure, yes.
Eileen, thanks very much. Thanks very much for your call there. There's a portion of the book where you send your protagonist, Nan, back to China.
Yes.
And I wasn't really so much asking about how you imagined or created that, though that's interesting. But I'm reading along very deep in the book here, and suddenly, you know, you're saying he climbed the stairs, he's in Beijing, and reached his parents' apartment.
Yes.
And I couldn't help wondering if that must not be a kind of fantasy of yours, something you have not or not been able to do. Do you fantasize about going back to China? Do you long for it? Are you free to? Your books are not permitted to be circulated there.
No, only Waiting. Waiting was published, then it went out of print.
Right.
So there are some pirate editions. Yeah, I often dreamed of being in China and talking with friends.
Can you? Are you welcome? Will the Chinese government permit you to? Why haven't you gone back? Is it choice or are you forbidden?
As a citizen, I think there should be no problem. I can go back now. But I was not that
eager. As a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, as a U.S. citizen. But in the first 10 years, for some years, I couldn't have my passport renewed. I couldn't travel outside the United States. At that time, I was very eager and was homesick. And gradually, I guess, I got jaded, and that desire was not so intense anymore.
You don't long to go to China 20 plus years after leaving?
No, I realize that even friends, they have changed, because we don't share the same interest anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to be realistic about this. If I go home, go back, I would just be very private. It would be just a private visit, and as I said just now, you left the place. People there have changed. The place has changed. You yourself have changed.
How has China's remarkable economic rise, mm-hmm. never mind the politics for a moment, I mean, what's your sense of how it's changed the Chinese immigrant, especially more recent immigrant,
his
attitude toward China, looking back on it? There's a place in the book where you have none, and he's trying to decide how he now thinks of these. And he thinks, well, China's like my mother. The United States is more like the woman I love.
Yes.
But China's become so large in the world today. Uh-huh. Has it changed the way Chinese look back?
Some immigrants, yes, and especially a lot of Canadian immigrants. They want dual citizenship, but China would not give them. And there are a lot of people that would buy an apartment back in China so that they can retire to it. But that's for me. That is not an option. As I said, life is a journey. One should always travel once you are on the trip, because to return very often that means you accept the finitude of life. And for me, that's why. And China doesn't mean I would cut myself off from China. Mm-hmm. I know China is always part of my heritage. But the past that should be used as a source for energy rather than a burden.
There's a passage in the book that surprised me where you have Nan reading an article by an older scholar, poet named Yang Chu.
Yes.
And he's written an essay in your fictional telling here called Why I Don't Want to Be an American Citizen.
Sure.
And he said he couldn't be an American citizen because if it ever came to a conflict between these two great powers, he wasn't so sure which side he could be on or that he could fight against China anyway.
Sure. Yes, I think that was, that's a real, real effect for any immigrants we have to face. Uh-huh. And because the swearing ceremony is a solemn occasion. You give your word, your promise, that if there was a war and you are supposed to perform non-combatant duties.
At least to defend the U.S. Constitution.
Yes, uh-huh. That was very solemn. Uh-huh. And so for now, he thought about this, but finally he decided a promise weighs more than a country. I think that's the truth. I think for me, I believe in that. You give your word, you have to follow and be faithful to your word.
So the older poet in your book says, I just can't go there. But Nan, your protagonist does. Yes, he says, uncertainty tormented him, but he also knew that once he swore allegiance at that oath ceremony, he would be bound by his words. To him, a promise should weigh more than a country.
Yes.
A promise should weigh more than a country.
Yes.
Interesting. Let's turn to Joanne, calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Yes. I just want to thank you for writing this book and to speak out loud for our Chinese immigrant, because I lived in this country for almost 20 years. And I still have that feeling that you mentioned in the book. It's the common feeling, I think, among all the Chinese new immigrants. It doesn't matter how long we've lived in this country.
Sure.
And you just can't get rid of that feeling that you can never speak freely with your mind. And also do whatever you think it's right to do.
Joanne, in other words, you mean the old Chinese feeling that you should watch what you say. It's hard to shake that.
You can never shake that off.
Uh-huh,
it's in our blood. I totally agree with the professor.
Yeah.
And now that I have my daughter almost 5 years old, and I'm trying to see what she learns and what she copies from me, and sometimes that's frightening because I just teach her things that unconsciously that I never want to have her to do, and to things that I didn't want to happen on her.
From your cultural history that you'd like to spare her. But Joanne, let me ask, Hajin, you're a writer. Surely you've shaken this feeling that you have to not be fully open. Being a writer means being fully open, pretty much, doesn't it?
Sure. I try to, but I agree with Joanne. You cannot shake it off completely because, somehow your sensibility, your mind had been at least once formed by all these things, concerns. But I think I have reduced that a lot. I always try to remind myself to speak freely.
Joanne, thanks very much for your call. There's a moment in the book where Nan is with, I'm not sure, a friend or an acquaintance called Da Ning.
Yes.
And who's been quite successful.
Sure, yes.
But morally, has become kind of morally suspect in Nan's
sure,
eyes.
Yes.
And there's an interesting thing you put forward. During his visit, it upsets Nan because of this contradiction, this tension.
Yes.
For the following week, he went on telling his wife that success was the mother of failure. He's looking at his successful friend, Dunning, but he's turning upside down Chairman Mao Zedong's famous quotation, failure is the mother of success.
Yes.
And it left me, what are you saying there? Mm. I mean, that success in immigration, in economic terms, immigrating to America, then somehow turns one back toward failure necessarily?
You know, in his case, that's his opinion. Also, in his case, his friend's, Dan Ying's case, really the success may really somehow corrupt this man. And the man, in fact, there is a desire to be decent, to be good, but somehow he just couldn't manage. But in Nan's case, I think he... failure was gradually became a big part of his mind, because he realized that he was heading toward failure.
That he wasn't going to be a poet, that he would be a restaurant guy forever.
Yes, that's why
failure in his mind.
Yes, that's why for him success really shouldn't be something to be desired, and he is in a way he tries hard to accept the failure.
There's a funny moment here where. His son, who comes very early, but then he's growing up, and at a certain point, he's looking at his father, and there's the intergenerational stuff, and he's kind of Americanized and got the angst. He looks at his poet father, not a great success in his view, and calls him a douchebag.
Yes.
And Nan doesn't know what this means and can't find it in the Chinese-English dictionary, and his son protects himself by refusing to tell him how to spell it, so his father can't figure out. There's the immigrant intergenerational meeting.
Very often, you know, the parents who couldn't speak English well, the child basically function as the connection between the parents and the U.S. society.
But here's a connection that the wise son is not willing to fully make.
Yeah, he can manipulate.
A little bit. Let's take a call from Sheffield, Massachusetts. Warner, you're on the air.
Hi. Greetings to Ha Jin. I read both his books, The Waiting and War Trash. Mm-hmm. And I know that he writes in English. And I was more interested, I mean, the conversation has sort of taken a direction as being kind of cultural and political and sociological. But I was more interested in some of his points of view about literature that had influenced him. I'm sure there was some Chinese, but I don't read Chinese, so I'd rather be interested in what he thought of English literature, you know, if there was any influence there at all. I'm sure there must be. And one writer in particular who he reminds me of is a Yiddish writer, Isaac Bashevis Singer, who wrote about the old country. He was an immigrant, but after a while, had he been here, he started writing about America.
Yeah.
So I just want to hear what he's got to say about writing and literature in general.
Ha Jin, your literary influences that go way back to when you ended up in one of the first generation in college after the Cultural Revolution, how would you describe it?
You know, when books before this book, they were basically were heavily influenced by European authors. For instance, in the case of Waiting, Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary, and Fathers and Sons by Turgenev, and those were big influence. But this book echoes the American immigrant literature, and so there are influences, but they are American influences. For instance, My Antonia by Willa Cather, that's a big influence. Mm-hmm. The view, the understanding of the land as a character.
Willa Cather.
Yeah. And Henry Rost Call It Sleep, how to present languages on the same page, different languages, but on the same page.
Which you do here with italics representing Chinese, and it becomes ungrammatical but quite rich.
Yeah, and also the child fear in that book. But my book wants to go further about the adult's fear. And Nabokov's Punin was a big influence, too, stylistically. And Punin has basically becomes a different character when he speaks different language. And also the playfulness, how to use distortion and misuse in the language to create a style. and that is a big influence. There is an older novel by a Russian Jew called The Riots of David Levinsky. I think that was, I read it many years ago, but it was always in my mind for a long time. That is toward the end, the protagonist became a very successful businessman, but he felt lost, empty.
And Isaac Bashevis Singer?
And I don't know about it, because I think his big novel, Shadows on the Hudson, was published recently. I haven't read that book.
Of course, many more before. But
yes.
Not directly part of your influence.
Yeah, but that book, I think, according to some criticism, that book somehow, in a way, related to this kind of writing. Yes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me get one more call here. Dick is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Dick, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
Hello, hi, Jin. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Dick.
I'm calling to remind everybody that aside from writing this novel about a poet, that Hajin himself is a very distinguished poet, and by some coincidence, I actually am his poetry publisher.
Yes.
So you look back to Between Silences and Facing Shadows, Wreckage, his volumes of poetry.
Hanging Loose Press, and I just want to tell everybody that he's a terrific poet, and I wanted to say as soon as I finish this pile of poetry manuscripts on my desk, I'll be reading the new novel.
You know, I plan to send you a copy, Dick.
Amends made. Let's amend it also with one more reading. Our time is short, but there's a poem right at the end in the book to be in the voice of Nan, the main character. It's called Another Country. It really speaks to our theme.
Another country. You must go to a country without borders, where you can build your home out of gallons of words, where broad leaves shade familiar faces that no longer change in wind and rain. There's no morning or evening, no cries of joy or pain. Every canyon is drenched in the light of serenity. You must go there quietly, leave behind what you still cherish. Once you enter that domain, a path of flowers will open before your feet.
Hajin, reading the poem Another Country, presented as a poem of his character Nan in his new book, A Free Life. And here we are in yet another country, not China as I read it anyway,
yes.
and not the United States. This
sure.
is the country of the poet.
Yes, it's artistic domain.
The land of his imagination, of his creativity, of his free mind.
A space where he can fully exist as an artist or struggling artist.
Does your Nan successfully make that emigration by the end of the book?
He tried. I think he can fail at any moment, but he's willing to choose to fail as a free man.
Is China going to know that freedom, or does it already in its poets?
It's very hard. I think it's very hard for this book. I think it's maybe very hard for most Chinese to understand. It is about the American immigrant experience. In other words, the references somehow would be absent to many Chinese readers.
Sure, the references, but the freedom itself that you describe at the heart of it, and ultimately the literary freedom, don't Chinese?
I think, yes,
they know that?
The spirit, they would, as any human beings, I think that is universal, sure.
But on a very different path.
Yes.
That we're able to see fully fully in the light of your years, and now you're sharing this book. Really wonderful intimacy here in the book, intimacy with the experience you describe, and we're very grateful to you for sharing it with us. Hajin, thanks for the new book, A Free Life, and thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Hajin, his latest novel is A Free Life. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can also download our podcast. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Allison Bagg, Noah Hertz-Bunzel, and Ping Wong. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.